Hi, I'm Allison Pease, Associate to the Provost for Faculty. This spring, John Jay is awarding the Distinguished Teaching Prize to three extraordinary professors whose work inside the classroom deserves recognition. To celebrate the dedication of these individuals and to learn a little bit about what great teaching looks like, I'm sitting down with each of them to ask them about winning the prize and teaching life at John Jay. In today's episode, I interview Assistant Professor of Sociology Carla Barrett. Carla joined John Jay in 2010. She is a researcher in the juvenile justice system and published a book, Courting Kids, Inside an Experimental Youth Court with NYU Press in 2013. I begin the interview by asking her what it means to her to win the Distinguished Teaching Prize.
It really felt like an honor, and I felt honored even more than I expected that I might be. You know, I've been interested in caring about teaching for a really long time, and to have that recognized just felt really, really good. And to have it recognized on sort of a campus-wide level, it kind of makes me feel that all that hard work just got recognized. And I would have been doing the hard work anyway, but it's just very nice to have it acknowledged. And it's actually made me want to get even better at teaching.
But you were nominated by two professors from a different discipline. You're a sociologist. These were English professors, and they commended you for your commitment to writing across the disciplines. In particular, they said that you're a model of the writing-intensive approach. And in your own statement, you talk about a student-centered approach to learning. Can you tell me what a typical Carla Barrett class period looks like?
Well, I don't know if there's a typical one, but what I try and do as much as possible in my classes is to not rely on lecture, not rely on PowerPoints. There are times when some lecturing needs to happen in certain courses, but normally a typical class, you come in, there's some announcements, and then oftentimes we get right to doing group work. Sometimes it's small group discussion that then gets turned into a large group discussion. I find sometimes getting students talking to each other first in small groups before we try and have a large discussion just gets the juices flowing, get them comfortable articulating ideas about the readings or whatever the topic of the day is. Other times I have much more focused sort of workshop activities. They'll come in, I'll have them split up into groups, and I'll have a set of tasks for them to complete in regard to the reading or those sorts of things. And then usually out of that, there's some sort of reporting back. There's some sort of bringing it all back together. Maybe each group has to pick one idea that they think is the most important to bring back to the group. Or if I've given different tasks to different groups, sometimes I'll pass out a different question for the reading and each group has to tackle it. And then they all sort of report back, and I use that as a way to engage the whole course. Oftentimes, there's a free write component. So either at the end of that, take out a piece of paper, what's resonating, what are your questions? You know, sometimes that's a free write at the beginning of the class that says, okay, your paper's due next week, how's it coming? So a process note where they get to reflect and understand. And that's more for them than it is for me. Free writes happen at various points often in all my classes, even the ones that aren't designated officially writing intensive. I think it's a great way for students to check in with themselves. I often have them anonymous. I will collect them just so I can kind of, you know, have some insights into what's going on with them. But that, I would have to say that's probably a more typical day.
Yeah.
Is some sort of breakout work that brings us all back together. It's not always the same dynamic. It really depends upon what topic we're working with. If it's a dense text, I find breaking out into small groups with assigned tasks works better. It really kind of depends upon what we're working with in the class.
And can I follow up a little bit on group work? Sometimes students complain, sometimes professors complain that group work can feel, unfocused, or that you'll have a group where some of the students are prepared for the class period, some of the students aren't. How do you ensure that group work is good work in your class?
Well, the issue of having not all students come to class prepared, I think, is just a constant challenge that I've never been able to master, but I do. In a lot of my writing intensive courses, there's a response paper due every class. And so that is the expectation that you will come in, right. You know, and that is an incentive to have the reading done.
And you grade each of these response papers for every class period from all of your students?
In some of my writing intensive courses, I do. In the writing intensive senior seminar, the capstone course, they have to keep journal entries, mm-hmm. and I collect the journals a few times over the semester.
Got it.
I don't tell them when I'm collecting them.
Right.
Which is their incentive to keep them up. But I don't, because that ends up being too much.
Mm-hmm.
I find that's another technique that works, so that they're writing and coming in with something prepared. Sometimes I'll go around and just check, do you have it, and mark that in my book, and that counts mm-hmm. for participation and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I do randomly collect the journals. But that helps.
So
but
having
not
students come in prepared ensures better quality group work. Are there other things
yes.
you do with group work?
I think there's so much more I can improve on in this area. I'm still learning and growing about this.
We all are.
But I have found the sort of task-oriented techniques, like, you know, we read in one of my classes last semester, Eduardo Bonilla Silva's Racism Without Racists,
mm-hmm.
a couple chapters from that. And it's some pretty dense stuff. So I will devise questions, you know, from the reading, key concepts that I think are in the readings, and find a question that gets at those. You know, on page 42, Bonilla Silva writes blah, 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 how does this, you know, and ask sort of these targeted questions, and then give those to each, different questions to each group. And I find sometimes that kind of focus, sort of, it gives them something to do. Sometimes it's, okay, what did this book mean to you? Talk to each other. But that has to be closely monitored to make sure they're not talking about something else.
Right.
I do a lot of walking around, checking in. I try to hit every group when they're doing this. You can kind of tell which group may not really be focusing, and try and give them a question or something to bring them back on task.
Mm-hmm.
So some of those kind of techniques work. There are some books and some issues too where I think students need the freedom to mm-hmm. wander a bit and to start talking about one thing and then maybe end up talking about something else that's connected. You know, I have a problem sometimes of wanting to control too much the dynamics of learning in my classroom,
mm-hmm.
and I'm learning more and more that you can't have it just be willy-nilly whatever, because then it does become unfocused and those sorts of things. But there is this other side of it that for some things, especially controversial topics, difficult topics,
mm-hmm.
sometimes just allowing students to find their way through that is another important aspect.
In the materials that you submitted after you were nominated, you talk about the challenge and the necessity of talking about race in your classes. As a white woman, do you think there are more, or maybe equally importantly, less effective ways to address race that can help our students at John Jay learn?
Well, I think if you're going to study, research, write, or talk about the criminal justice system, particularly in the United States, you have to be talking about race.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say almost the flip side as well. Race and racism is so deeply embedded into our legal and history of our criminal justice system and our current criminal justice system that I think we're not doing our jobs if we're not talking about both of those. I've had a lot of conversations with colleagues that care about teaching, and we've had a lot of conversations recently about what it means to talk about race and other difficult issues in class, given our own individual positionality.
Mm-hmm.
So my friend who's a black male professor, right, his positionality in regards to talking about this is very different than mine.
Mm-hmm.
And how students read what we bring to the table about that is very different.
Mm-hmm.
And we're actually trying to work up a panel for a conference talking about exactly these issues, because it is very different what I bring to the table on these issues. And I have found that the best approach is to be profoundly honest and even vulnerable, if you will, with my students about these issues. I call out my whiteness all the time. That is one of the advantages that I have, you know, that maybe my black male professor friend doesn't have, you know, or he's going to, there's going to be a defensive response maybe if he's seen calling out whiteness in a way. But I reflect on my own experiences of white privilege and how that functions, mm-hmm. and bring in issues of intersectionality because, of course, I'm female and those sorts of dynamics. But I find that I've had conversations in classes where I'm like, this is kind of difficult stuff to talk about, especially right after the verdict or the lack of an indictment in the Eric Garner case. Mm-hmm. I came into class and like, do you want to talk about this? And it's like, yes. And we talked about in my class how hard it is to talk about this stuff and mm-hmm. how people are afraid to talk about race because you might be racist or you might offend someone. And I have just learned over the years being really honest about those things and not trying to be the expert mm-hmm. In any way, shape, or form, and sort of owning my own positionality, I think has worked as much as I can guess. I also have had the benefit of studying the social construction of race and critical race theory in my discipline over the years. So I also feel like I have a bit of a intellectual or disciplinary vocabulary, mm-hmm. which I don't know that everyone who teaches feels that they have that. Mm-hmm. And I think people can feel very ill-equipped if you haven't had the opportunities to sort of train around dealing with these issues, both in terms of scholarship and teaching.
Scaffolding is a word that gets used a lot in terms of assignments. Everybody uses scaffolding as a word, but it's not clear that everybody always has the same understanding of what it means. And it's something you talk a lot about. It's also something that those who nominated you for the teaching prize talk about, your ability to scaffold writing assignments in particular. Can you walk us through what your approach to scaffolding is?
Well, I think it always starts, and this I've had to learn how to do, but it starts with really trying to figure out what my learning goals are for a given assignment. I think we often come up with assignments and we like them and they're good, but we haven't always thought through what is it we want our students to learn from this process. And with a scaffolded assignment, it is a process. It's not an assignment. First, I try and come up with that. And then it's a matter of trying to figure out what the steps are involved in that. When it comes to, say, in my senior seminar class, where they have to do a fairly large research paper, I reflect on what it takes me to write a journal article. What are those steps? What are those phases? Right? So first you got to collect some sources, right, and organize them. And then maybe you have to create a working outline, right? And then there's an attempt, you know, a few pages, an attempt, starting to create something that looks like a document, right? And then at some point there's a draft mm-hmm. and a final. And so I have built those pieces in. I also try, I found this to be very helpful, is to be very transparent with my students about the learning outcomes for assignments. I think sometimes we know why we're asking students to do something, but they don't know.
Right.
So I do a lot of, why do you think I'm giving you this assignment? Mm-hmm. Right. Is this busy work? Right. You know, I'm a stickler for APA citation formats, like very much a stickler, to the point my students are often shocked that I'm like, you know, this is not proper APA. And I've even had students like, why does it matter so much? I'm like, that's a really good question. Is it just because I'm a perfectionist, which I am? But that's not the point of the assignment, right? The point is not to memorize APA and know it for the rest of your life. You know, and I explain to them, out in the world, you're going to be asked to seek information and apply it. And that's what this exercise is, right? It's an exercise in attention to detail, mm-hmm. which you're going to want for some things that you do in your life, like resumes and those kinds of things, right? And so I find sometimes if I really explain, this is the goal, this is the learning outcome, this is what I want you to get out of this, even for some of those various pieces in a scaffolded assignment, students are much less resistant to going along with that process. Mm. And I've had a lot of students say, you know, doing this paper in all these parts was so much easier. And that they learned a lot more. And I give a lot better grades at the end of those scaffold assignments. So that's another incentive for me, because I get to read much better final papers at the end than if it was just, here's a paper due at the end of the semester. So in other classes where it's not just about so much a paper, in my juvenile delinquency class, we have a large scaffolded assignment that is really about them getting to understand basic theoretical concepts in the course. So they have to read a full book and write a short book review on it. But they're put through their paces on about four different scaffolded pieces of this overall project, where they have to keep coming back around and revisiting the theory and getting together in groups with other people that read that same book with the list of theories and go, okay, which ones rise to the top for this book? And then putting that all back into their revised review. So that for me isn't so much about these pieces of a large research paper, but I was finding that students by the end of the semester weren't owning theoretical concepts as much as I wanted them to. Mm-hmm. So by doing this, I almost think of it as a spiral, not so much a scaffolded, you know, one tier, two tier, three tier, but almost a circular design that keeps bringing them back around and going a little bit deeper on each one. And I found that, again, the final papers, the final book reviews in that class, students had a fluency with theoretical concepts that I hadn't seen before.
They say the mark of expertise is knowing how inexpert we are. What do you want to get better at?
Not talking.
So far, so good. Explain.
In my classes, I think sometimes I'm too willing to fill in the gaps. I'm to fill in the empty spaces. You know, when students are struggling, I think I'm still a little bit too much inclined to take over. And yes, it is my job as the professor. I don't want to abandon those responsibilities, but I think I just checked out a book. I haven't had a chance to read it. I'm forgetting the title now, but it's something like Teaching Without Talking. That's really one thing I think I need to be better at, is to give up a little bit more of the control, a little bit of the control I have in my classes, be a little bit more trusting. You know, every class is different. Even if it's the same subject, there's a different dynamic with each group, whether it's time of day or the room or who's in it. So I also think that needs to be adapted as you go along, where some groups are willing to just jump in and do work and others need more guidance. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, you know, you constantly have to adapt. But that is something I would really like to get better at. And I'm teaching a brand new class this semester, so I've had a little bit of a chance to experiment with some of that. At one point I was wanting to assess about mid-semester, are we hitting the learning outcomes for this class? Because I've never taught it before. Like, am I doing this? So, and I had this moment where I'm like, well, I can go look at that, but why don't I have students look at that? So I brought in the learning outcomes, typed up, and had them sort of rank, how is the course? Are you learning these things in the course on a scale of 1 to 5? And we had a discussion about it.
Wow, a nice metacognitive moment.
Yeah, and there was one of the learning outcomes that none of them really understood the language of, which was really insightful.
Yeah.
That, you know, but so that's something I don't know that I have done as well as I would like, is to bring students into that conversation even at the beginning of the semester about the learning outcomes. But it was a really interesting experiment just to, you know, last night they were peer reviewing their papers, and rather than coming with the peer review worksheet that I normally create, I came in and said, so what do you think are the criteria by which we should be judging each other's papers? And we created that rubric together.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit more of that, and yeah, a little less of me in the room I think that's my biggest challenge right now.
One of the books on teaching I read last fall was called Small Teaching. The philosophy is essentially most of us who've been teaching for a while aren't going to do dramatically large overhauls of our teaching practice, but that we can make small adjustments that can have positive impact on student learning. in the spirit of small teaching, is there something that you do that you think others could make a small change in their teaching to adjust to that does have a positive impact?
I think a lot of my colleagues would not think it is a small adjustment, but I have a complete convert to writing across the disciplines and writing across the curriculum, particularly when it comes to using writing as a tool for learning.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you, right? I think so often we have conversations at John Jay about student writing. Mm-hmm. And it's not about writing to learn. It's about writing as evidence of having learned. Right. So I want to focus on writing to learn as something different. How do you understand it?
Well, I mean, the whole writing across the curriculum world, there's these two, you know, streams. One is students should be writing so that they can learn to write,
mm-hmm.
right, and articulate what they've learned. And the other side of it is the philosophy that writing is a tool for learning. And I believe in both. And if I had to come down on one side or the other, I would come down on the side of writing as a tool for learning. By putting words on a page, we coalesce ideas in a way. So this is the free write exercises, those kinds of things, the having short response papers due to every reading. And at first students groan a little bit, but after a while it becomes easy. And what I figured out too is to make those short response papers as quote unquote as long as they need to be.
Hmm.
Because the work is so much better when students just say what they thought about the reading without it. It has to be 2 pages. It has to be 3 pages.
Right.
Right. So, and this is somewhat low stakes writing, right? It's a response paper. It's an engagement with the text. I don't want a summary. I want you to have some sort of reaction.
Right.
And I went to an undergrad where that was in every class across the entire campus. That was just the model of teaching. So it's how I learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that students benefit so much from it. Even if you sit and write a half a page and throw it in the garbage, there has been a coalescing of ideas in that moment. And
right.
I think
you now know what you think about that topic, even if you throw the paper away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even day one, what do you think you know about, you know, what is due on day one of juvenile delinquency? Take out a piece of paper before they even get the syllabus. How would you define juvenile delinquency in this moment? Right. These kinds, and that's not a huge change in one's teaching. And I think oftentimes people think to adopt writing across discipline ideas, they have to do some big, huge thing with scaffold assignments. And they do, but I think there are so these little ways that I have just found to be so useful. If you're teaching and if you're new at teaching, to do at the end of a class, you know, what questions students have in a free write gives you feedback immediately about whether students are grasping the concepts, right? What are one or two big takeaways from this lecture, this discussion? And doing that and collecting those and, you know, reading them on the subway mm-hmm. will give you tremendous insight into whether or not students are learning what you want them to be learning. So I think there's lots of little ways that that kind of writing can be put into courses that I would like to spread that around.
Carla Barrett, Distinguished Teaching Prize winner for John Jay 2017. Thank you.
Thank you.